to the Mom Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick, and my co-host is Chris Lucian. And excited about a fun conversation today we're about to have with Alan Holub and Rob Williams. I'll have them introduce themselves, but we'll be talking about no rules for mob programming or product development in general. This basically started as a Twitter conversation between us and Alan and Rob, where we were talking about mob programming rules or roles or a pattern of some sort, and it got quite lively. So I'm like, let's turn this into an episode. This should be fun. Before we dive into that topic, though, Alan, go ahead and introduce yourself, and then Rob afterwards.
Well, I'm Alan Holub. I wear both the architect and the agile guy hat, and the two are pretty tightly connected in my mind. So I can't really tease them apart. I do a lot of consulting on those topics, both with companies that are already good and want to get better and companies that are not good and want to get good. mostly in the agile process stuff, though lately I've been doing more architecture than in the past, mostly around the incremental architecture areas about how to design things so that you can build them incrementally, as domain-driven design, that kind of stuff. And I'm active on Twitter and LinkedIn and places like that. We should put my Twitter handle up at some point, but that's the best way to get hold of me. So that's me. I've been doing this since dinosaurs roamed the earth, so I have a lot to talk about.
Speaking of which, that's one thing Alan and I have in common. I've been programming since the 80s, started with C++, did Java for a long time, and have become polyglot in the last couple of years, doing new stuff all the time, programming in multiple languages per day. Did swarms back in the 90s. So I was always interested in the idea of getting everybody to work on things, but we did that as kind of a tactic back then. The idea of just doing it as the primary really seemed appealing about a year ago. So we've been doing a lot of mobbing now on my current team. I personally love it. I have had people on my team who I've had to kind of talk into the boat or keep from jumping out of the boat. And I make arguments a lot about there's mobbing and there's caveman. And so I'm constantly trying to keep that argument fair, you know, not just an attack on the things that are wrong with mobbing. But I love it. And I think one of the things we were talking about in that thread that was really interesting was Alan's been on Twitter for years talking about how did Agile get hijacked? How's a lot of that messaging gone wrong? And I think I jumped into that thread to say, for God's sakes, let's not let the same thing happen with mobbing. Let's not turn it into a you know, nitwit set of rules that if you didn't do them exactly right, you're going to be shamed and told you're not a real mobber and all the other silly stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great introduction to the topic. And I think, so from my perspective, it's pretty interesting because mobbing's been around quite a while now. We're coming close to the 10 year anniversary, I think. And so there's been different
September,
teams.
I think.
What's that? What's that?
Sometime this, you know, between September and December of 2021 will be the 10 year anniversary of the mob programming, sort of like calling it mob programming and talking about it at conferences and stuff.
Oh yeah, fun. So what I've only been in the world a few years now, but what I've noticed is that a lot of teams that, you know, you look at a lot of the books, you look at a lot of the talks by Woody and Llewellyn and almost everyone does two things. One, they make a mob timer themselves. For some reason, everyone does that. And then the other thing is they start developing and at least someone kind of takes on the anthropologist role and starts documenting experiments or patterns they've seen in the mob. And I think, and you know how tough Twitter is, right? You only have so many right. characters in a tweet. And so you say like, oh, here is the driver navigator. And it, you know, it sounds very rulesy, like, oh, the driver types and he doesn't talk, or he only listens or only asks questions and the navigator speaks. And I think, you know, publishing stuff like that can sound very rulesy in the bad kind of way. And I guess maybe that's what I'm here to talk about. When is it good? When is it bad? Where's the line, you know?
Yeah. I'm actually writing a mob timer. So
that's awesome.
There we go. Well, the reason is because I couldn't find one that did what I want, right? I want one that works in a remote world where the entire mob can share a single timer. Yeah. And the stuff that I'm finding is not really doing it. So the timer is like you
all agree we're going to stick on this for another 20 minutes and then it runs while the mob's going, or
yeah, that kind of timer. And ideally
that's like a Pomodoro type thing.
Well, Pomodoro helps to mix Pomodoro into it, right? It's like not force people, but recommend that they have breaks once you go one time around the loop.
Sure.
And that kind of thing. But mostly it's a matter of everybody having the same timer in front of them.
Yeah.
And to do that, you need something on a server, and all the mob timers I'm finding are just running full JavaScript on the client. And that's no good.
The other thing that's really cool about that is in having done a lot of mobbing recently, I think that time really is important, and time in other systems like Scrum is so phony most of the time. It's like, we're just going to put phony time boxes out. The iteration's in 2 weeks. It's a train. It's leaving whether your piece is there or not, you know, whereas timing and mobbing, a lot of the times it's like a lot of things are going to come up and you just have to stop and keep asking yourself, are we still on the right path? Are we solving a completely different problem? Should we refocus on the use case, et cetera? So I'm really interested in integrating that with some tools too.
Well, yeah, that goes back to what we started with though, right? Is that the time thing, right? Is that one of the things I see go wrong is people saying, well, we must have 7-minute intervals or whatever it is, right? They decide it. And then they do that as if there's somebody with a whip standing behind them who's going to beat them up if they go over their minute. And so I see stuff happening because of even rules as simple as that one, right? Yeah. It's people stopping in the middle of things where they should just keep going for another minute or two to finish it up before they swap drivers. And they won't do it because the timer went off. And I think a lot of this starts with people who are just starting and they don't have any help. They don't have anybody sitting down with them who's done it before and give them some guidance. Yep. So they feel that they have to have rules to work from, and they follow them rigidly and they never stop. Yep. And there's a lot of risk in there, right? I use mobbing for all of my classes. I don't do any hands-on classes that are not mobbed anymore. But they've got me sitting there helping them. So that works a lot better than somebody sitting down with a bunch of rules and deciding to implement the rules. And that's my fear about these rules, these lists of rules.
Yep.
That people will take them as prescriptive. And the more there are, the more prescriptive it is, the more things you have to do, the more obstacles there are to starting, because there's so many rules to learn that you feel like you can't even start because you've got to learn all this stuff first before
right.
you can even start going. And it doesn't work for me. You know, if you want to identify patterns, okay. You know, anti-patterns in particular, I think are useful. Things like runaway drivers and that kind of stuff. It's useful to kind of go with that ahead of time and sort of be able to head off problems before they come up. But the flip side of that, the pattern side rather than the anti-pattern side, I'm kind of dubious about is the at least if it's too formal.
Yeah. Right.
So what got me started in that Twitter thing wasn't so much that people had rules, but that you were formalizing them onto a wiki. And once they get formalized, then they're fixed and concrete in some people's minds. And I really hate that.
Yeah.
I think you can say the same thing about code design patterns, because I was a guy just the other day that was implementing design patterns just because they were in a book and had no idea what problem he was solving while implementing that design pattern. And so I find that many people will identify those patterns and kind of take them as doctrine and try and implement them without knowing why the pattern exists.
Yeah, well, to an extreme, right? As I remember, what was it? It was probably the Head First pattern book. One of the second generation design patterns books. And it was getting slammed on Amazon reviews because the examples were not identical to the examples in the Gang of Four book. They said that basically this guy said this notion that it was cut and paste. And if it didn't look exactly like the thing you cut out of the Gang of Four book, it was not a design pattern. and that that's no fun. Author who was talking about design patterns knew what they were talking about unless their examples looked exactly like the ones in the Gang of Four book.
And now people walk around saying the Gang of Four book is useless because the examples are in C++.
Yeah, right, exactly.
What kind of insane argument is that? But also the other thread going through this conversation that's super interesting is the parallel in the real world to the domain of cooking and food, which is most people, when they get interested in baking or cooking, they get obsessed with recipes and they get into this mind frame of like, I must have done something wrong. I've got to go back and just because all I'm here to do is figure out the formula to produce the output that I want. And that would be, I mean, mobbing can't, if it turns into something like that, it'll be a complete farce and a charade. I think one of the things that's great about mobbing is it's the exact opposite. We're sitting there saying, even if we did caveman and we let people take their piece and go on it on their own, we're presuming that there's some linear path that they're going to follow and nothing's going to happen to them while they're doing it that would, you know, necessitate or benefit from additional conversation, et cetera. To me, if you're going to argue, when people come in and say mobbing's ridiculous because you have two people doing something that one person could do, it's like, well, probably what's ridiculous is your concept of what that one person could do. Because yesterday in the mob, we were working through a step function, an AWS step function. Those things have been around for a really long time. We're using an article. It turns out this article has references to functions that have been deprecated for a while, and yet we couldn't find any other step functions implemented in TypeScript. So we're essentially sitting there rewriting it and updating the code to it. Now, in, you know, this linear world, you're not supposed to, there's no accounting for any of that. You should have just been able to go over there and implement the function. So I think the idea in mobbing is the exact opposite. There isn't a simple recipe. You're not just going to go combine the four things and have a loaf of bread pop out.
Mm. And this challenges a kind of an assumption I've had for a while, because I think there's two sides of me that are fighting, and maybe you can help me resolve it. So one is, if you have kind of the spirit of mobbing internalized already, and then you go to like a pattern library that someone's published, and I read the gist of it, it has like, in this context, you know, if you're having these problems, maybe try this experiment because we had these results. You know, it's kind of like, I'm just sharing something and try it and see if it helps you. And in certain cases, I'm like, yeah, we are having these problems. And I tried the experiment in the pattern and it really helped us and we love it. And we've tried it, you know, when those problems pop up again. But then there, like you said, there's this problem of it becoming a set of rules. And it reminds me of a saying that maybe it applies to mobbing. Mobbing can't be taught through a rule book. It has to be caught, so to speak, from someone who's done it well. You know what I mean? Or because it's, you have to be in the flow, in the context of the team that's learning it to kind of show them the ropes. Like you can't hand them a rule book.
I think that's true. That's absolutely true. Because certainly when I go in and teach it, people pick up on it almost immediately. And the same with the resistance thing, right? Every time I've gone in to do a mobbing class, people are going, I don't know that this is going to work. And then by the 2 or 3 days later, they're saying, I don't know how we ever worked without doing it this way. So there's a lot of suspicion up front. But the other thing, right, to make another parallel with design patterns, it's all context specific. Right? Every one of those rules is going to be context specific.
Yeah.
And the risk of a rule book is that people lose the context. Mm-hmm. They think I should be following all of these rules without thinking about where does it make sense?
Or even skipping past the detail of like, you know, oh, you do retrospectives and modify your process. So Scrum for you should not look like Scrum for everybody else, right?
Yes.
Like all of it has kind of, you know, I think people have a tendency to kind of like read the parts that they like and then take that back to everybody that they're excited about, and then it gets misinterpreted, right? It's kind of like the telephone problem.
They don't read the Scrum guide at all. But you know, the new one, this latest Scrum guide a month ago, right? The 2020 version is the first one that is actually describing an agile process in my mind, because it is the first Scrum guide that does not require a retrospective to produce a result that fits within the Scrum framework.
Nice, yeah.
Right, it's the first one. And so it's actually possible to there's an escape clause now, right? You can retrospective yourself out of Scrum. And that never was the case before. And part of that was because there were too many goddamn rules, excuse my language. And so again, we cut back to the rules for mobbing, right? And here we have all these rules again, right? It's too easy for people to fall into prescription.
Yeah.
Unless there's a specific rule that says there are no rules. Right? Rule number one is there are no rules.
There are no rules.
well, also the other thing I think that's pernicious about wanting to go to rules is, I can't think of a time when I've engaged in a conversation with somebody who was down on mobbing where their argument wasn't ultimately an efficiency argument. And the efficiency arguments are stupid in a lot of ways, but one of the main ways they're stupid is they presume knowledge of, you know, planning. And this is another thing that if you read back through Alan's tweets, you know, he goes on some planning tirade at least once or twice a week. which are awesome, by the way. But the other thing too is that whenever you get into conversations like that, you have to remind people of what a counterfactual is. You can't argue that I went the inefficient way unless you can actually prove to me that this other path would have gotten me to the same place in less time. So those kinds of efficiency arguments are really silly. And thinking that rules are going to keep you more efficient, that's also, there's a psychology part of that, right? So you take psychology of the rational versus the irrational, or put it in Nietzschean terms, like Apollo versus Dionysus. Everybody thinks if you don't have rules, then it's chaos. It's just total anarchy. You know, you're not going to get any productivity at all. They're all just going to sit there and do whatever they feel like doing, and your product's never going to get released. That's part of the reason why I think Alan's story before is the truth. It's like you get people walking, then when they get to their first thing, they're like, oh my God, I thought I'd never deliver anything using this technique now that I have. So yeah, the rules, I think, serve those two purposes. They try and make the control freak Apollonians feel good, and they try and make them feel like they're squeezing efficiency out of the team who dared to ask for a paycheck, like Oliver, for another bowl of mush, you know?
Yeah. So I guess my follow-up question then is, I think any of these pattern libraries or roles or these kind of things you've seen in the mobbing world that are shared online, there's like a repository of them and things. I think the people who have shared them, me being, I've contributed a couple patterns to them, so maybe I'm guilty here, but is the intention is, wow, we ran this experiment and it was really cool and it really helped us. I want to share with other people this because maybe it'll help them too. And it's not like I'm giving you a rule book, I'm trying to share, I found some cool stuff, how do I share this with you? You know,
that's not a pattern though.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe that's the problem, is calling them patterns, right? Is having an accounting, right? We had this problem and here's how we solved it, and that might work for you. That's great. But that's not a pattern, right? A pattern is when you look at
that's what I would call a case.
Yeah.
A pattern is you have a bunch of groups,
all have the same problems, and there's a category of solutions that solve that problem in all cases. That's a pattern. And that's not what you're calling patterns. Hmm. Patterns are discovered, they're not invented.
And the other thing your question begs also, which is super interesting, is I've had so many conversations with people about patterns where they say, I'll say to them, well, let's walk through composite or some pattern. And like, well, I didn't memorize them. And then I say, well, how do you use them? You wait until something happens and then you pick up the book and go through all 23 of them and see which one applies. It doesn't make any sense. And the Alexander thing in the beginning, it's a pattern if you learned it and then you start to recognize it in the environment, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there probably are patterns in mobbing. And I think that is an interesting question. But I agree, a case and a pattern are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. A specific problem is a case, and a case database is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a Stack Overflow type thing.
The patterns are probably the similarities between all the different patterns that have been published.
Patterns might be in the similarities, yeah. If you put together all of the cases that were addressing similar problems,
and then
you saw a commonality in the solutions, then you'd have a pattern.
Sure. That's in essence what the Gang of Four intro says, is we got talking with each other and realized that we had similar experiences that recurred again and again, like Decorator.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, for example, the one, let me think of one. For some reason, the one that always jumps out to my mind is like a My Turn for Learning pattern, which is where you have some people in the mob who, if you're doing a timer-based navigation, like timer driver navigator type pattern, there's some people in the mob who are completely new, you know, like have no context to the domain or completely new, and so they're not able to navigate. And so the pattern says like, oh, well, something you can try in that scenario when they just, it comes to them and they're just like, I have no idea what to do. And then they just defer to someone else to navigate is you say, hey, when it's your turn to navigate, just ask questions until, and then to learn more. And so it's like a learning session every time it's their turn to navigate, right? And so.
Is that the best way to learn?
I don't know. So it's not saying it's the best way to learn. It's like, hey, this has helped us in some cases. And so sometimes we've used this pattern case, I don't know, and it's helped us, and other times it hasn't helped us and we got rid of it quickly.
Yeah, but that's really context sensitive, right? People learn in all sorts of different ways.
Yep.
And you really don't want that context swap in there where you go from working to learning to working to learning if you're not learning things that you need in order to get the work done, right? There's a big context swap there. I can see all sorts of downsides to that.
There's another interesting thing in that question, though, which is I was going through one of Feynman's books last year, and he talked about when he was put on a commission to understand what happened when the shuttle blew up, that he went over to JPL and they wanted to just dump all these books on him and tell him, here, bring yourself up to speed. And at one point he said, are you guys crazy? I've got like a week. How is that possibly going to work? So instead, what he did was he sat down and he started trying to talk through his understanding. And then as he got to holes, he would ask questions. And then they would say, oh, well, this guy Bob is the dude who worked on that part. Let me go get him. And, you know, Feynman, of course, is making the argument in his book that that worked in a way. But he makes the broader argument that that is self-directed is a good way to learn, especially when you're learning in a deficit situation where there's a lot of people who know more than you around you, but they also have a shared conceptual understanding that you don't have. So, I think that's a pattern that could definitely benefit. By the way, I think learning is a great argument to use against caveman because if you're doing something like that step function thing yesterday, and we finally wrestle that thing to the ground, either if we do it in caveman, we end up in one of two awful situations. We now have one person on the team who knows how to do it, or we end up deciding that whatever it took to wrestle the pig to the ground is useless information. We're ready to discard it and move on and just hope we don't encounter it a week from now. Whereas in the mob, we do it together and we all come out the other side and we talk about it. This morning, that was one of the first things we did. We talked about what we thought of some of the things that, you know, it ended up taking to get that thing to work. And then we move on together. So, and Alan's made these arguments a couple of times in Agile in general, is that if you see learning as done in a post hoc JIT fashion, then by definition, the team is always behind and, you know, filled with holes that you're just waiting for a failure to prompt, you know, to allow somebody to free enough resources for somebody in management to be willing for you to caulk that hole.
Yeah, you know, and there are solutions to that too, right? Are you guys still doing a learning hour every day? That's something I learned from Woody, which is a great idea, right? And but that focuses, right? It lets you get ahead. So it lets you decide on something you don't know as a group and you think would be interesting to learn about, and you as a group learn it. Yep. And you're not waiting for the necessity to know it, right? You're not waiting for the crisis before you start having to then put things on hold in order to learn something in order to solve the crisis. Approach, right? So getting back to where we started, right? If you have this pattern, that's the I don't know what you would call it, the slow learner pattern, where a navigator decides to learn during their time slot.
Yeah.
And then people start saying, well, this is the way we have to do it then. Your host, yeah. Right?
No, definitely not. Right? Yeah. So
it can't be prescriptive, but I think like one thing that the patterns libraries, quote unquote, and have really helped with that I've seen, and this is specifically to the mob programming RPG, is that there's kind of like different levels, and it's like, okay, learn, you know, how to drive and how to navigate first, right? And then kind of graduate from there. And so I like this idea of just saying, if you don't have somebody to teach you, and this has happened, right? Like I've been asked on Twitter, how do you do this when you don't have physical access to somebody who's done this before? This was before everything kind of went remote. Kind of the idea there was like, hey, try playing this RPG. It has a couple of things in here that you might.
Yeah, but I don't like games either. I'm not a big
Yeah, sure.
You know, and the just watching a team mob effectively is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
And there's not enough of that, right? The stuff that you guys are doing with the occasional sort of public mobbing sessions, that's good.
Yeah.
But just recording those and having a library of, here's a bunch of teams mobbing in order to solve specific problems, watch them. That doesn't strike me as bad particularly, right? In fact, it's pretty good, right? Because you get a feeling for how it all actually works in practice.
I think that's one of the reasons why YouTube is just a freaking unstoppable juggernaut. For God's sakes. I mean, people who used to watch shows all the time, you know, I finish the news and a lot of times I'm watching a guy repair his washing machine 1 minute. And then I'm like listening to a guy make an argument about how easy it is to tack PEX up under your floor and have radiant heating. I'm like, oh my God, that looks outrageous. So and the other thing about what Alan's saying that's kind of interesting too is back away from patterns for a second and say, maybe you just end up with reams of that stuff. I mean, we're using Google Meet for ours. So we're recording every single mob session. Then Google provides a transcript. And my dream is to be able to produce excerpts and to be able to do things where you could do searches and stuff like that. Because, hey, we're going to, we will have touched step functions, for instance, 4 times, you know, this time, that time, this time. And maybe just even end up with indexes that allow you to dig back into that content or to catch people up. I think the other really interesting thing that runs through this part of the conversation too is the other part of learning that Caveman just completely leaves out is Caveman assumes everybody is at their desk at all times. In the same way that computers, you know, when you learn how to write code for mobile devices, the first thing they teach you is the server is not there all the time. If you write your app assuming that, your app will be an utter failure and it will be deleted by 80% of people who install it. And so I want a mobbing team where I'm not sitting there going, oh my God, it's 10 o'clock and Dave's still not here. Right. And if Dave comes at 10 o'clock and we've been mobbing for an hour, we have a little work log, we've recorded the whole thing, you know, he can skip through that and he can catch himself up. So learning is not only, hey, we let these guys be totally non-productive and play around with some new function. It's also learning your own stuff. It's making sure everybody on your team is staying up on where everybody is.
Yeah. Oh, I like that a lot. And that's super cool. You're sharing about you guys recording and then having the notes and stuff like that kind of automatically made. That's incredible. And, you know, so we have a playlist we created that's us remote mobbing at a conference. It's Canton Coders that has Woody in there. It's got some from Llewellyn and then some from the remote mob programming.com guys or .org guys. And so, and I think no matter what it is, I think the heart of it feels like to me is, I guess, the word rule versus case or experiment or something like that, right? Because you could even watch one of these videos and be like, okay, unless we do it just like Woody did or just like Llewellyn did, we're doing it wrong, right? And so And so I feel like you said at the beginning, it has to start with rule number one is there is no rules. Yeah. Right. And no matter
you're not doing it wrong and you're not a bad person. Yeah. Right.
Because as soon as you approach it with that less rule mindset, then you're good. Right. You're like, okay, I'm seeing someone else's experience and maybe this is something I'll try. Maybe it'll work for us. Maybe it won't, you know? And so I guess I don't know how to communicate that. What's the best way to communicate that before you share anything? Just state it always at the beginning of every tweet or every article or every video. How do you?
Or maybe disarm, like I said, disarm some of the reasons why people want rules. Just go straight at the Apollonian arguments, go straight at the efficiency arguments. I mean, and plus on the plus side, there's a lot of things that mobbing does that you're never going to get out of caveman. Like when I watch some people on my team code, I have mad respect for them. I'm like, that dude is an artist. It's like caveman, you never see your cohort's work. What kind of an insane setup is that?
There's no learning from the...
There's no learning. Yeah, you can't learn how to get better. You can't get better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing too, is I'm like, so let's not just, you know, totally call for anarchy, but I also believe that the future of work is going to be more like people working where they want to work. I mean, we're seeing a lot of things on Facebook now where Twitter now, where people are coming out and saying, there's just, if you had a reason to be an employee at Facebook, it's gone. Get out of there, you know. And the same thing
after yesterday, yes.
and you know, why are people working in these gigantic organizations? Because they offer benefits and they pay high salaries, etc. But programmers are some of the least money-driven people on the planet, and especially good ones love doing it. And I really feel like mobbing is going to seduce those people. And if you said to them, come mob at this company, you might get paid 15 or 20% less, they would do it in a heartbeat. Or if mobbing just becomes like, you know, I personally think a lot of the workplace things that have cropped up like Upwork are kind of dystopian right now. Alan, I don't know if you've looked at Upwork, but I can just projecting Alan's Twitter feed into Upwork.
I will look at it and then rant about it.
The swiftness of the gavel coming down. But yeah, it's not the future of work I'm guessing Alan would want. It's certainly not what I would want. But imagine a future of work where we're all just, you know, I might decide to join a mob with you guys tomorrow because you're doing something that sounds fascinating. And comp is maybe, you know, in tokens, or you're going to pay me or whatever. And then I use the tokens I earned that day to do my own mob 2 days from now on something else. And I've got 8 slots and I attracted 20 applications, you know, something like that.
Wow. Yeah, that would be super cool. That's kind of like Chris and I have speculated in the past, like what would it look like? If you've heard of the FAST framework or something like that, where it's basically at the beginning of the day, there's like, okay, there's these 8 things to work on, go split up and figure it out. And then, so people decide every day, which mob or pair to join to go figure something out, what that would look like, as opposed to being like, oh, I'm on this team and this team has this backlog, right? Or, vision that they're working on. So,
yeah.
So that's one I've thought of that a lot. And I've thought that's also potentially a way to scale mobbing would be that maybe as your team grows, you have people who are essentially competing, you know, in a mild form, right? Because like you're attracting more people to your mob because your stuff is more interesting and you're doing a better job of, you know, facilitating and you're, you know, the flow is better. And that's not really, I mean, that's the way some organizations have worked in the past. Like at JPL, for instance, you might be on a project for a while, but if your project ends, you essentially go to the cork board. And you
JPL and the MIT Media Lab is another example. Those are, I think, almost perfect environments for creativity, right? When people have that kind of flexibility. And you hardly, if I were to record, well, maybe I will do it on Twitter just as an experiment. But if I bring that up on Twitter, I can guarantee you that I'm going to get attacked by all the people saying, well, in the real world, you know, and all of that crazy corporate stuff about this is the way we do it in corporate America. And that's the only way you can work. And it's not like this.
Yep.
Right. And
as soon as that phrase, the real world, comes into the conversation, kaboom, it's blown up.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, one of many, but that's probably the biggest one in the real world.
By the way, on this topic, Alan, if they drop that one on you, you can ask them, you know, when's the last time you dropped a lander on Mars?
Well, yeah.
That's kind of real other world, if that's your argument.
Yeah. But it comes up a lot. And the cavemen are the people that are most most like that, right? They're the thing about the caveman argument is that they're always the ones that hate mobbing, and they're always the prima donnas, right? The ones that hate mobbing the most are the prima donnas on the team, who see themselves as the team lead, who see themselves as the one expert that's holding everything together, and they order their minions what to do, right? And it's like, talk about an anti-pattern. Right, that's a huge one, and it stops. That sort of attitude is encouraged by most companies, and it stops the sorts of things that we're talking about dead in its tracks.
You guys, I'm sure, saw that thread that went bananas on Twitter last week, where that CEO came out and crapped on front end developers, then it just turned into like tribal. But that's exactly what you're talking about. It's like that guy, the guy who hates mobbing, the caveman, is the guy who's like walled up inside some little cocoon somewhere, convinced that the work he's doing is totally critical. And sure, you can't click on it, but come on, just get one of your minions to put a lousy HTML page out there. That's below me. Somebody else can do that.
Yeah. Well, Chris, you were gonna say something. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was saying, like, you know, that whole in the real world argument, right? Like, I think one of our goals where Austin and I work is to be that real world example of how it can be different, right? And so I think it's important for people to talk about what they're doing that is outside of the norm, that is working better than what.
Well, certainly, you know, that time lapse video at Hunter with the six teams, the second one, not the first one, but the second one. Mm-hmm. Is pretty valuable for that. Mm-hmm. People say, well, we can't do that in the real world. You just plonk that down and say, here, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the it's hard to argue with success. And
And I think, Chris, I don't know, so maybe we need to make a remote version of that video now.
Oh, absolutely.
Wouldn't be a bad idea. Yeah. I'd like to see
it. Less grandiose, but maybe if we had every single screen recording at the same time and showed it from a, you know, a standpoint of remote mobs. Because now I think, you know, we hover between 7 and 8 remote mobs. And it works really well as far as... it just works really well. Everything's really fluid. I think that it's easier now that there's not physical travel distance between locations on our campus. The actual collaboration across the entire organization has increased with remote. So, I'd say the difference between before and after remote, we've actually gotten more effective because we can get access to the people that are usually have, you know, a few streets ahead of us before we can actually get to them. And that's been really cool to see.
Well,
that's kind of a false dichotomy, though, is that we can do the connectivity stuff that we do now with remote, even if we're co-located occasionally.
Yeah, but you're mentally not there, right? Like, so the thing that I noticed beforehand is because we were already saying, hey, just call the person up and put them on a video call, but it just wasn't the go-to. Like, no one thought of it as the default mode. And now that it is forced to be the default mode, there's no question about it. And the likelihood that somebody's going to pick up the phone is, you know, multiple times more than what it was back then. And it's because it's like, oh, they're going to be by in 30 minutes. Let's just wait for them to get here. And all of a sudden you have all this queuing start happening. And what I've noticed in where, you know, it's like partial remote versus everybody remote. I think the everybody remote has forced behavioral change across the organization. I guess it's a little off our topic, but it's I think it's been cool to see that, you know, forcing the issue has created a mental shift, and that has meant that you now instantly have access to the person that, you know, before you had access, but now it's actually a reality.
And that's very much a cultural issue inside Hunter, though. It's that
I can, some of the companies that I've worked with, they could never do that. You know, and part of it is things like a false sense of politeness. Oh, yeah. We can't interrupt.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a bunch of kind of, I can see that as being a really good thing. What you're describing is really good. And I can also see it as being really hard for a lot of companies to pull off.
Culturally speaking, like when before we started mobbing and the kind of the first day we started doing stuff like that, or even when I just first started there, you know, one of the developers had basically said, "Oh, we don't talk to that person because we can't, you know, we don't really talk to them." I'm like, "Well, they're just a couple cubicles away. Like, we should just
go." Oh, God.
and so I think that actually exists in a majority of organizations. And I also think that it's kind of like, it's just fake, right? And so I think kind of just round out this idea of like, how do you grow mobbing without patterns out there? I like this idea of like, most of mobbing growth that I've seen, just anecdotally through these interviews and things like that, has all been kind of organic, right? It's like, hey, I'm going to invite this other person who's never mobbed before, and I'm going to invite that other person who's never mobbed before, and then those people invite other people, and so it's kind of had like this, you know, sort of geometric growth over the last however many years of people showing other people what it's like to.
Which is sort of an argument against doing it remotely, right? Is that I've been many times on site, working with a group. And somebody walks down the hall and or whatever, if it's a big open office, they just walk down the aisle and they say, "What are you guys doing?"
Yeah.
And I'd say, "Come over, join us for a few minutes, get a feel for it," right? And then a day or two later, I'll walk by their desk and they're mobbing.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a lot of diffusion of information that comes from these sort of ad hoc encounters, right?
Yeah. That,
if you're mobbing, if you're mobbing online, you're not going to see it. If you're mobbing remotely, you're not going to see it.
But right? That's also potentially an opportunity, a solvable problem. But the other thing on what Chris was saying that's kind of interesting too is, you know, the Mythical Man Month, which I'm still, you know, heartbroken that there's not an audio version of it because I'd listen to it once a month. But one of the things he talks about in there is, you know, what always happens at an organization that doesn't want to change is eventually they're forced to, and then they come up with the idea, let's put a team on this. And immediately you have the two cultures problem, okay. Which is what the Tracy Kidder book is about, right? The two different teams that were going to make the 64-bit computer that was going to compete with DEC. And the two cultures problem is a disaster. That's an unsolvable problem. And so that's the other thing about mobbing is I think that's one of the we started this conversation with what went wrong with Agile, why did it get co-opted and turned into a bunch of nitwit rules and a certificate mill? And that's part of the answer is that the guys who didn't want to change co-opted it, and they want to make a little group of Agile within the gigantic waterfall, you know, overarching structure. They want to just put it on a little shed on their, you know, surf territory and say, okay, we're Agile. We did that. And, you know, I think mobbing has to be, I can't see, you know, it can't be contained within an organization that continues to do things caveman.
I think you're right. I don't think any of the stuff that we all talk about all the time can happen in a split culture.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest problem, right, that I have, certainly as a consultant when I come in, but everybody has, which is a company where some part of the company wants to keep doing things the way they're doing now, and they see Agile as something that you can do in some little tiny corner without any kind of real support or help, is it doesn't work that way.
And they have some power, so they basically, it ends up being a standoff.
So it's not a standoff at all. They just prevent agility from happening entirely.
Yeah.
And the you get more and more lip service over time and less agility.
That sounds like a good title for another episode. I think we're very close to our time box. Actually, I think we might have exceeded our time box. But this was a really great conversation, guys. Thank you for being on the show with us. It's been really great to have these discussions, and we'll keep Twitter active, and we'll keep doing the show. Yeah, awesome.
I was just going to say, well, we want to give them a chance to plug anything before we close, if that's cool. And the one thing I wanted to close with was got to talk about how not to frame mobbing to turn it into a rule book or a cult. I think that's what you called it, Rob. Yeah. So that was good. And also I think embedded in there were a lot of agility things and how to maybe make the case for mobbing and to do it with as much kindness, consideration, respect, but also critical of to the ideas against agility and mobbing. So I think that was fun. So thank you for that. Rob and Alan, is there anything you'd like to plug before we close?
Not a whole lot. I had a long agility video series that I started and then petered out on, and it's coming back together. So that should be done in a month or two, actually, at the rate I'm going now. So if you're interested in that, log on to my website on ahold.com and sign up for the mailing list. There's a subscribe link, and I'll send you a note when it's available. And of course, if you follow me on Twitter, that's the best way to both keep in track, get on track, and also get hold of me. So,
and get involved in these discussions.
Absolutely. The more the merrier. One of the things that I do on Twitter very consciously is that I see it as me running a discussion group, not as Twitter. Right. I kind of want to throw out some topics and get people to discuss them because interesting things come out of that. And I learn a lot, of course.
Absolutely.
You know, that's a thing to do.
How about you, Rob?
No plugs from me. I'll plug my as yet unwritten volume on mob philosophy, which is definitely coming up on my radar as you know, might encompass everything from political action and anarchy through through us finally throwing off the yoke of serfdom, you know, 600 years after the medieval period ended. But I totally enjoyed being on. You guys have a great channel. I'm going to catch up on some of your playlists.
Fantastic.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah. And I'm guessing there'll be an appendix with all the mob rules in that book.
Mobber and super mobber. We can look for it. We can look for it on Amazon.
All right. Well, you know, I'll use that as an opportunity to ask all of our viewers to share this episode with anybody that you think it will be personally impacted by it. And thanks for joining us. And Austin, anything else?
Nope.
All right. So bye, everybody. Thank you.
Mob well. See you.